begin the slideshow. Hide some things. All right. So the title of today's lecture is Group Level Cognition. Do groups have minds of their own? In recent years, there has been a liberal turn in philosophy of cognitive science. I mean, liberal in the sense of sort of freely spreading something around. There has been much talk of cognition, memory, decision-making, intelligence in non-standard systems. These include plants, individual neurons, extended systems made up of individual human organisms along with their artifacts, and groups of individual humans. This last case has led to a newfound interest in the idea of group minds. Now, in the first part of today's lecture, I will focus on the very general issues in the background. You see the title of this second slide is shared kinds, generic kinds. Much of this will be an exploration of kind of what it would be for very different kinds of systems to share the same kinds of mental states or share the same kinds of cognitive processing, so that we understand what it would mean to say that a plant has cognition or a group has cognition, what it is that we're really asserting when we say that. And then in the last part of the lecture, for the last third or so, I'll talk fairly specifically about group minds. So if that's what you're especially interested in, bear with me, we will get to that topic. What often goes unaddressed in these debates, or is addressed only superficially, is what is meant to be shared across cases. What is the shared thing? We can entertain the idea that there are different kinds of cognition, for example, plant cognition or group cognition or individual cognition. But what would make them all species of the same generic kind cognition? What do they all have in common such that that common thing itself qualifies as a legitimate natural kind or scientific property? And this raises the more general issue of generic kinds, an issue that's important in debates in philosophy of cognitive science that have nothing directly to do with non-standard purported thinkers. Pain eliminativism has been discussed a fair amount lately in the philosophy literature. Is there such a thing as pain? I've mentioned memory before, and we'll talk more about that momentarily. Attention, is attention a real thing? Just that very notion of attention. Concepts, are there even beliefs? Is that too general an idea to really do any work in cognitive science? In each of these cases, the concern has arisen that there are only species and that the genus evaporates, in which case specific kinds discussed aren't really species at all. They're just different kinds. That's why I put species in scare quotes there on the slide. Because if there's nothing that two supposed species share, two different kinds of pain share, then they aren't really species of one overarching kind pain. They're simply two different kinds of states or processes. In the case of memory, the study of memory from an orthodox perspective, not about plants or groups or extended minds, the study of memory from an orthodox perspective has revealed a wide array of kinds of memory. There is procedural memory, declarative memory, episodic memory, semantic memory, spatial memory, memory for faces, and more. The question arises, what makes them all forms of the same thing, memory? Some leading memory researchers have concluded that there is nothing essential that is shared and have embraced eliminativism about memory as a genus in cognitive science. Endel Tull is a good example here. And I'll make a follow-up remark to something I said in a recent lecture. I was discussing memory eliminativism in passing, and I attributed the view to Fergus Crake. Endel Tolving says this in an essay that Tolving and Crake together edited, a book they edited includes an essay by Tolving, but the essay is only by Tolving, not by Crake. So that was a mistaken attribution of the view to Crake. I apologize for that. But I don't think it's a really peculiar view, as if Tolving's the only one that holds it. I think many memory researchers are mostly interested in studying their own little corner and don't necessarily see any commonality between their form of memory they study and all the other forms. Now, in the case of group cognition or plant cognition, the kind that we're interested, at least initially, one of the obvious things to ask about anyway, is the kind cognition. So what sort of kind is cognition? Here are two possibilities that I'll explore further. One is that cognition is a structural, organizational, or nominal kind. The concept or label cognition structures investigation, but it doesn't designate a property or kind that itself does causal explanatory work. Chomsky has made remarks over the years about academic disciplines, and it might be a useful comparison here. The idea that he thinks departments or disciplines, say a department of linguistics versus a department of sociology, right? These are artificial in a way. They don't really correspond to any deep divisions in the way the world is. They're organizational tools for management and bureaucracy and organizing conferences and to sort of make things happen. But there's no correspondence between the departments and like special areas of nature. Similarly, this is just a comparison. The idea of cognition isn't, on this first view, it doesn't reflect any real division in nature. But on the second view, cognition is a genuine natural kind or scientific property. Cognition designates a genuine kind, part of the furniture of the universe, that plays a causal explanatory role when investigated fruitfully as part of the scientific enterprise. In fact, it's because it's investigated fruitfully, it's because we discover the causal explanatory role of cognition that someone who holds this view thinks that it's a genuine natural kind or scientific property. So part of today's lecture will involve trying to sort of sort that out, trying to figure out whether there's something we can identify as the kind cognition that would play an important causal explanatory role, accounting for data or variance in data collected in cognitive science. Well, corresponding to the first of those two options, the idea that cognition is a merely organizational term, is the idea of a thick science, a very rich, complex science I'll say more about, but without cognition. Cognition is merely an organizational tool, but it organizes things that are themselves very interesting phenomena. So according to the option, the kinds that cognition organize have rich, complex, causal explanatory roles, which I'll sometimes abbreviate CE. Or if they themselves don't, the kinds that they organize do. What is interesting about the kinds and processes studied is their elaborate and subtle causal profiles, which produce complex variations in behavioral data. So perhaps there's no cognition. It's a useful organizational tool. It gives us departments of cognitive science or conferences on cognitive science. And perhaps even some of the things we kind of collect together under the topic of cognition, like memory, themselves are not natural kinds. They're also organizational tools. But eventually we get down to the level, say, with specific kinds of memory, spatial memory that's used in navigation. Maybe that, now we finally got to the thick part of the science where we find kinds and processes studied that are elaborate and subtle in their causal profiles. In this sense, the processes investigated by cognitive science are thick, but cognition itself evaporates. There's nothing remaining for humans to share with groups, individual neurons, or plants. On the second option, cognition, it was a real, but I'm afraid, possibly, only a thin kind. According to the second notion of cognition, cognition is a genuine scientific kind, but it appears to be thin. It's difficult to identify a scientific kind of cognition, a property that human remembering, decision-making, language processing, et cetera, all instantiate. one that might also be present in non-standard cases. The apparent candidates are highly abstract and don't appear to do much causal explanatory work of their own, and I'll go through some of these cases. Instantiating them tells us little about, for example, how to intervene productively on cognitive systems to produce systematic variation of scientific interest across cases. So there are a few very, I think, very important points embedded in here. One of them is this last point about intervening to produce variation. So we're trying to find a shared kind, something that plants and humans, that groups of humans and individual humans could share. And we want it to be a kind that's of interest in the sciences. And typically what that amounts to, especially in an experimental science, is that the kind can guide manipulation, intervention, sometimes called experimental control. The worry is that we might be able to find something that kind of counts as cognition, but there's so little to it, it's so insubstantial that it can't guide this sort of intervention to change things. And I'll talk a bit more later about what kinds of interventions we would want to be able to perform. Now, there's an aspect, another aspect of this I wanted to remark on. Why is it interesting or important to point out that even if cognition is real as an overarching kind, it's very thin and perhaps uninteresting? I think it's important to point out because often when philosophers and some cognitive scientists write about group cognition or plant cognition, for example, they really want us to think that the examples, the different kinds of cases share something really deep. Like, think about this maybe in the context of what's a sensitive subject for some people, but say animal rights. Should we eat meat? Some people don't like the idea of eating meat because they think cows, for example, are very deeply like humans. But that requires that cows and humans share something really deep. And so it's that kind of claim about affinity or being very, substantially similar that is driving a lot of the interest in plant cognition, for example. If plants have very different states and very different behaviors, there's a very thin thing that they share with humans, then it really doesn't amount to much to say that plants are thinkers too, or that groups are thinkers too, in the case of group cognition. It doesn't indicate any deep affinity between humans and the other cases, if all that's shared is this very thin kind. All right, well, that's some of the kind of motivation for interest in this. Let me give you a quick history of cognitive science, a potted history, means it's, sort of simplified and sketchy, but maybe helpful. We begin cognitive science by observing anchoring cases, as in the case with any science. In this case, they're human behaviors, humans engage in conversation, prove theorems, write and deliver academic talks, design experiments, play chess, organize governments, produce works of art and architecture, hiccups, and so on. We have a hunch that such activities will be subject to unified treatment, and we also have arguments that a behaviorist approach doesn't work. And so cognitive science is born. But as it proceeds, cognitive science becomes highly specialized. And the discipline produces a highly articulated set of models, data from specific domains, rather than general principles that might be thought to capture the nature of cognition. Now, don't get me wrong, throughout the history of cognitive science, philosophers and cognitive scientists have, stopped from time to time to say, but here's the general nature of cognition. It's computation or, what have you. But on the ground in labs, what's being produced, sort of day in and day out by those working on cognitive science, doing experiments and interpreting data, is not a theory of cognition in general. These are highly articulated models, detailed models of specific forms of behavior, the variance in those specific forms of behavior. The result in functionalist terms, for those of you familiar with that kind of literature, is that the characterizations of human cognitive processes that emerge are chauvinistic and broad. They're broad because cognitive science studies tasks that involve interaction with specific media, such as sketches, experimental apparatuses, mathematical formalisms, written texts, the physical schools one might send one's child to, that they might go visit to select a school if you're in a position to choose between schools. Now, this point about broadness is important for more than one reason, but it can also serve as a reminder of something I said, I think, in yesterday's lecture. When toward the end of yesterday's lecture, I was asking the question whether the theory of cognitive integration that I had offered was merely a theory of systemic integration, what makes something a system rather than a cognitive system in particular. And the response I gave, which is going to be relevant today as well, the observation I made is that it is important to identify systemic integration, but what makes a system a particularly cognitive system is that that integrated system is producing the behavioral data of interest. And these cluster together here in ways that I have on the screen, or you can see a kind of list of those data, those kinds of behaviors that are here on the screen. And it's just that these can be performed, but that they can be switched between and that they can be pursued by various strategies and so on. But the idea is partly, again, that the being a cognitive system in particular, as opposed to just a system, may amount mostly to this relational fact, your integrated system that produces certain kinds of performance. Now, this leads to, in some ways, to a kind of chauvinistic view, because these tasks and various aspects of them are largely species specific. Other entities don't do any or most of these things anyway. Plants don't have experimental apparatus. They don't seem to make sketches, like artistic sketches, and so on. And to the extent that maybe the case with groups is a little trickier, because you might think, well, groups use mathematical formalisms and they deal with written texts. The question in the case of groups is whether it's really the group that's doing it or whether it's the individual members of the group that are doing it, and then adding their performances together. So let's think more about this merely organizational notion. The little history of cognitive science I gave suggests a compartmentalized view of cognitive science. It produces specialized models of various task types of interest and is made up of a variety of relatively independent areas of research. Now, ultimately, we want to wed these together by making what are sometimes called whole agent. We want to be able to describe the whole system that produces these various types of behavior and accounts for the ability to, say, switch between them and pursue different ones in different contexts. But in order to build up a whole agent model, the strategy has seemed to be to first understand the particular domains, the various task types, and that leads to these relatively independent areas of research. So areas of study include, just to kind of trot out some examples, memory consolidation, human-computer interaction, reinforcement learning, implicit bias, visual imagery, mind wandering, ship navigation, syntax semantics interaction during sentence processing, et cetera. And, you know, I honestly, part of the reason I make this sort of list is to try to get people thinking about the enormous differences between the the objects of study in cognitive science and the objects of study in plant science or in group science for that matter. There's more similarity in the case of groups. As a result, one might reasonably take cognition to be only an organizational kind, useful for structuring inquiry, organizing conferences, administering institutes, but nothing more. But it's consistent with that organizational approach that there might be a sharing of the more specific kinds. We want to explore that a bit. On the merely organizational approach, being cognitive doesn't amount to much, if anything, although one might still ask whether non-standard cases engage in processing or have states of the same specific natural kind as humans. And really, I should say, on the merely organizational approach, being cognitive doesn't amount to anything real. Don't want to be clear about that. That's part of the organizational, is that being cognitive isn't itself a natural kind or scientific property. But the point here is that one might still ask whether non-standard cases engage in processing or have states of the same specific natural kind as individuals. Even if there is no generic scientific kind cognition, it might still be the case that in non-standard situations, the entities in question share more specific processing and state types with humans. For example, memory or some specific kind of memory. But it's hard to share. It's hard to share given the detailed nature of the models constructed by cognitive scientists and the kinds of variations in performance that are interesting in the cognitive sciences. Take a given kind of behavior, choosing a career, just a human choice, you know, what will one do with one's life? Plants, individual neurons, and groups don't engage in behavior coded, I mean experimentally coded, in the way it would be in the investigation of the human case. So in parentheses here, I have some of the kinds of questions that might be part of the psychological experiment. Question, and maybe on a questionnaire given to the subjects, or maybe just useful for coding the data and then analyzing the data, even if subjects aren't asked about this directly. So we might ask whether the career chosen is a helping profession. Does it require a graduate degree, postgraduate degree, as it's often called? Is it traditionally male dominated or female dominated? Is it a high status profession? Is it a profession that one of the subject's parents pursue? These are all what might be known as, or sometimes called independent variables. So we might try to see whether coding the data for individuals along these dimensions can be used then to predict the value of a dependent variable, which is the career choice itself. So, but neither the dependent variable, the features just listed, nor the independent variable, the actual careers chosen, are the same across cases from humans to groups or plants or what have you. In the non-standard cases, the entities in question cannot choose to become doctors or lawyers or shopkeepers. There's no such thing as a plant lawyer or a group doctor. You know, again, the group case is more interesting, but I'm using plants here to kind of help see what the problem is and to address this more general issue of sharing that's been a kind of hot topic in philosophy of cognitive science. And in these domains, there are no such thing as graduate degrees in the non-standard cases. There may be, in the case of groups, some kind of group level certification of a corporation or a company, but companies don't go to school and earn a master's degree or a PhD. Well, one response is to focus on local sharing, and we will look at something like this later when we really focus on group cognition. Some philosophers have focused on specific aspects of those process models and have identified similarities between them. Consider, for instance, lateral inhibition, a specific mechanism that might be shared across cases, individual humans and otherwise. And the idea here, what I mean by local sharing, is the idea that one might look at a model of, say, a neuron's preference, how neurons respond to certain kinds of inputs rather than others. Got a mathematical equation that explains the neuron's preference in a way, or its preferential behavior, or its differential responses. We've got a mathematical equation that explains that. And then you have a mathematical equation that explains human choice in certain circumstances. And you see that part of that equation, or if it's an equation that explains a very specific part of the process, you see that that might be shared across cases. And that would be a kind of local sharing by finding some particular mechanism or equation that describes some particular step in a process that's the same across cases. So I'm going to talk here about lateral inhibition as a possible case. Lateral inhibition is a mechanism at work in, for example, visual processing. It can enhance the perception of boundaries, for example. Perhaps if we compare humans to neurons, we can identify lateral inhibition in organized groups of humans. And so this is drawn from an actual proposal, a paper by Rob Goldstone from Indiana University and some of his collaborators. This image, though, is drawn, I'm not sure from where. I've tried to figure out its source, so I have to be honest. I can't make a proper attribution here, but it's a useful image. It gives you the idea of lateral inhibition in vision. Let me talk you through this. So what we have here are six receptors labeled A, B, C, D, E, and F. These are across the top. They look like cylinders. And at the very top of the slide, you see high intensity and low intensity. So this is high intensity light, low intensity light. Now, at the high intensity, you see an activation being passed down of 100, sort of very strong activation, activation level of 100 on these bipolar cells, the red dots. So we get from the cylinders, the receptors, down to the next level, bipolar cells. How active will the bipolar cell be? What will be its response? Will it pass on all of the 100 to the next level or layer of neurons? Or will it pass on something greater or lesser? In the low intensity case, what's coming down from the receptors is an activation value of 20. It's only a fifth of the activation value. Now, one might think that the ratio here, 100 to 20, should be enough to allow the visual system to see the difference between the low intensity patch and a high intensity patch, to see a boundary between the two. But one can make the visual system even more effective by enhancing that boundary, making it more stark or making the contrast greater. And lateral inhibition is a way to do this. So, what you see down below, next to lateral inhibition, just below the bipolar cell response, just above the bipolar cell response, you see a series of quantities with negative signs, negative 10, negative 10, negative 10. And why is this? The idea is that these little sideways lines with the flat ends, those inhibit their neighboring neurons. They subtract 10. So if you take any one of these receptors, say take B receptor, which is in the middle, I think A is assumed to have further ones beyond it, but B is a clearer case. B is in the middle of A and C. Both A and C are activated at the level of 100, but they also laterally inhibit, that is to the side, they inhibit the activation values around them by a factor of 1/10. And so that means that A and C both cause a subtraction of 10 points of activation from the 100 from the level of activation of 100 of B. And so then the output at the very bottom below B is 80. So it goes from 100 to 80 because of lateral inhibition. You see a similar reduction by the same quantity in E over low intensity. There is a lateral inhibition of 1/10. So D and F both activated at the level 20, subtract 1/10 of that 2 from their neighbor E that's in the middle. So E goes from 20 to 16. So its output value there is 4/5 of its original value, just as the output for B was 4/5 of its original value. The interesting case is what happens to C and D. So C is stimulated at a high intensity. It is it has 10 of those 100 points subtracted by inhibition from B, the lateral inhibition from B. But the inhibition from D is only 2 points. So it goes from 100 to 12. You see down here below C, you see a minus 10 coming from one side and a minus 2 coming from the other. And so you get 88 as a result. In the case of D, the borderline, because these are the two boundary cells, this is what we're especially interested in, is a perception of a boundary. So in the case of D, you have low intensity light coming in, 20 points of activation, an activation level of 20. It gets reduced by 10 points of activation coming from C, that's the inhibition value from C, and 2 points coming from E. So now the 20 plummets to 8. And what was at the input, well, if you look at C and D, the input ratio was 5:1, 100 to 20. But now the resulting input ratio, because of this pattern of lateral inhibition, the input ratio for C and D all the way down at the bottom is 88:8. That's 11:1. So there's the boundary has been really enhanced. Okay, so what have I been trying to do? I've been trying to convince you that there are things like this. There are mechanisms discovered by, say, vision scientists who find this useful for a very specific purpose. There's neural evidence, evidence that this is realized or implemented at the neural level. It serves this very specific purpose of helping to enhance our visual experience of boundaries, but it's a very local circuit, a very local mechanism. And even if, so the claim might be that that kind of thing can be found in the relationship between group members, say, that group members would laterally inhibit each other in clusters of this sort. That's the claim Goldstone and colleagues make. But the problem is, the problem I see is that local sharing is not the same as global sharing. The kind of mechanism, like lateral inhibition, this kind of mechanism may be useful for many purposes, but its contribution to the production of behavior is a function of its setting, its overall or global role, as that is determined by the overall collection of mechanisms with which it interacts. Even when fragments of models, that's a way of talking about local sharing, even when fragments of models are shared across standard and non-standard cases, the global role of that shared fragment is typically not the same. The overall role it plays in generating output varies greatly from one case to another. And the overall models of this shared element, let me read that properly. And the overall models of which this shared element is a part may differ greatly. All that is shared is, as I've called it, a model fragment. And those of you who thought a little bit about, electrical engineering, for example, this would be true of other forms of mechanics or things of that nature. you'll be familiar with this idea that an individual part, an individual, say, circuit, a particular capacitor or resistor, could play lots of different roles depending on what machine you use to build out of it, or what machine you use it to help build. What we want to build are whole agents. So the contribution of a given shared fragment differs from case to case, depending on the richness of internal structure, including the richness of the interconnections between various parts of the overall model, and the ways in which the contribution of model fragments is modulated by architectural features, for example, metacognitive resources. So vision is a very rich and complicated process. It might be that lateral inhibition helps the human agent to perceive discontinuities in the light, these kind of boundaries between dark light, low light, and intense light, for example. It may be that lateral inhibition helps this particular purpose, but its contribution to vision overall and the way in which vision contributes to the production of behavior overall is very different, for may well be very different from the whole human agent than it is for the whole plant or the whole group, if there is a group case. So it's a kind of equivocation that proponents of cognition in the non-standard cases sometimes engage in, a kind of equivocation where they're moving back and forth between kind of two conceptions of something without making clear that they're doing so. It's one thing to say, hey, we found a shared process when it's understood just locally in terms of the little interactions between the very local parts. But to then jump to the conclusion that we found a shared kind and of cognitive state is say visual state is quite a leap that requires much more justification. This suggests that a model of the behavior of the individual neuron, plant, or group will share no more than a small fragment with a whole agent model of, for instance, a career choice in a human. The upshot seemed to be that there might be shared mechanisms looked at locally across standard and non-standard cases, but the overall causal role of such mechanisms will almost certainly differ radically across cases. We're left with different dependent and independent variables and different overall models of decision-making, memory consolidation, navigation, and their interaction with other subsystems in the whole embodied agent. So it's just not clear, because the point here is that it's not clear what's left, right? We have different dependent and independent variables. We have a different overall model, different whole agent model. All that's shared are some little local widgets. So the attempt to find shared specific cognitive kinds, whether or not, you know, in the absence of a scientific kind cognition, seems hopeless. We, you know, focus on specific kinds visual kinds, as in my example. The best we can do is find shared mechanisms with different roles in the production of behavior. Now, it might be that in some cases there's more promise than others. For example, groups do things like issue press releases. They use language in a way that, say, plants don't or individual neurons don't. So, you know, one of the domains that we might be interested in when we look at non-standard cases is language use. And that's a very, you know, interesting specific case. I think a primary concern about, my primary concern about the case of group language use is that the issuing of the linguistic properties of the issuing of a press release or a report from the government, these things, sort of group use of language, are a product of individual use of language. It's not as if the group somehow just produces this language. It's always via the actions of individual language users. And so there's a kind of derivative nature to this. That is, language use itself isn't an emergent property of the group. It's something that each individual member of the corporation or the political party, they each are capable of doing. And in fact, when a court decision is issued or a corporation releases a public relations statement, those things are always the product of the linguistic activities of individuals. So it seems like a science of the linguistic activity of individuals would be sufficient. Now, it might be that certain properties of language use across the group are kind of emergent, and that's an interesting case that maybe we'll be able to come back to that in question and answer. So one might wonder, though, whether some of what I've been saying misses the point. You know, that this emphasis on the difference between kind of independent variables and dependent variables. Yes, in career choice, humans are affected by things like whether the profession is high status, whether one of their parents engage in that profession, whether they'll need to get advanced academic degrees to engage in it. And those things aren't shared by groups or plants or individual neurons. But what we're really interested in, some people will say, is something more abstract, the idea of flexible behavior. So in the human case, the explananda exhibit more abstract properties, say flexibility in the pursuit of goals. Memory consolidation, sentence processing, et cetera, work together to produce adaptive problem solving in the face of changing circumstances. One of the central features of a system that exhibits these features of adaptivity is efficient task selection and switching between tasks or strategies. Perhaps cognition is whatever natural kind distinctively produces that sort of thing, efficient task selection and switching between tasks or strategies. Whatever process or kind accounts for that kind of flexibility, maybe that's what cognition is. This brings us to the possibility that cognition is a natural or scientific kind. You know, what we've been doing for the last 10 or 15 minutes is trying to figure out where to find commonalities between humans and non-human cases, even if cognition is not a natural kind. So we were looking for local similarities or some other kinds of similarities. But we're stepping back and saying, hey, wait, but there's still something, it's pretty general and abstract about the data in the human case, and maybe it carries over to the group case and the plant case, et cetera. It's this kind of flexibility. And maybe we do want to go back and consider the possibility that cognition itself is a natural kind, and it accounts for this aspect of the data. So, what are the ground rules here? Scientific properties are generally not individuated solely by observable similarity or dissimilarity, but by similarity in successful models of observable or measurable quantities. So we don't want to move simply from the observation of flexibility to the assumption that humans and groups have internal states of the same kind, or they're both cognitive, or they're both mental. Merely exhibiting the behavior of adapting to one's environment or efficiently switching between tasks does not suffice to establish sameness of kind or process producing those observable phenomena. Science is the search for hidden kinds. Computational processing and neural network processing, for example, are two different kinds of processing, although they can, in some circumstances, produce the same behavior. And this is true in, you know, across a wide range of sciences. I've used examples here from cognitive science, but two very different kinds of chemicals could produce the same effect. Turning a piece of paper blue. So. Earlier, I said, if cognition is going to be a genuine kind, or if we're going to sort of have any hope of finding a genuine kind, it's still going to be a pretty thin kind. Well, I want to consider a thin and thinner, but in reverse order. Let's start with the very thin case, and maybe try to make it more robust. We look for an element that contributes something distinctive to various architectural recipes across cases. On this view, even if there is no sharing of cognitive state types across cases, cognition could still be present across those cases because the same abstract recipe element is present. So I know this is very abstract, but think about the possibility that something like a network property, maybe something like system integration, could itself be cognition, regardless of what's produced. I don't think that's at all plausible, but it's possible to at least entertain that idea, of course. So any kind of integrated system is cognitive, right, you might say. But so that might be a way of sharing cognition across systems. But in that case, it might be that none of the more specific state types are shared. That is, you know, memory or problem solving, decision-making, I should say. These kinds of kind of specific types of processes that we investigate in the human case wouldn't be shared because even though an alternative example might have an integrated system, the output would be very, very different. And the style of processing itself, the hidden kind, would be very different when we looked at the specific processes that produced flexible behavior. But here's let's look at some proposals. Cameron Buckner, 2015, suggests that this is a certain kind of medial temporal lobe-based representation system, but that's the thing that's shared in cognitive systems. This may not be very promising, though. This rules out groups because groups don't have medial temporal lobes. They don't have hippocampuses. And the same goes for individual neurons and plants. But it could be this more abstract, this even thinner property of a network or system, such as being an integrated system, these things I talked about yesterday. The presence of that property might amount to the presence of cognition. Problem here is that in order to make these kinds applicable to non-standard cases, they must be made very thin. They must be interpreted in a very insubstantial way. The result is a list of possibilities such as having some coding system or other. We have to get away from the commitment to medial temporal lobe here for if we're trying to find something that's shared. But generalizing on Buckner's suggestion, we might have arrive at this possibility of having some coding system or other, or trying to generalize on some of the things I've said, being integrated in some way or another. Variation, which would seem to do very limited CE work, causal explanatory work, that is. Think of these as binary properties. I'm trying to say, you know, are these systems cognitive? Do they share the property of being cognitive? Yes or no, right? As binary properties, whether or not one has one of these properties will explain only the grossest differences, being intact versus being disintegrated. So, being able to respond in some flexible way or another to environmental contingencies or not. So, you know, if you think about a system integration criterion, it might be that what you get for a system that doesn't have any clustering of causes in the way I described yesterday, you might get a kind of disintegrated system. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's an interesting difference, a system that's just kind of a mess, a melted snowman or, you know, a puddle with very little structure. But it's not going to explain, it kind of explains the difference between alive and being dead. I'm exaggerating a little, but it's a kind of difference that's not, it's not what you get experiments designed to investigate in cognitive science. And notice that the idea of being flexible in some way or another, responding flexibly to environmental contingencies, can be itself is so thin. It looks like it might, you know, it might appear in a weather system, for example, right? Which is responding flexibly to contingencies around it. It's shifting and changing its shape. Right? So where do we draw the line in these cases? It seems so abstract. Well, maybe we can bulk up this these kinds of thin proposals a little bit, put some more substance on them. Only a very thin and admittedly relatively uninteresting kind from the standpoint of cognitive science is shared across cases. Perhaps we could think of these as necessary conditions for cognition rather than as cognition itself, one of the things I've been discussing. But that property itself can have species, that is more specific architectural or system-based properties that vary across cases. So this is a bit of a tricky point, but the idea is this. If you look for the presence of integration versus no integration, then maybe you're not really on to a really important distinction in cognitive science, but you may have identified what's a necessary condition for cognition. You haven't identified cognition itself, but you've identified something that has to be there in order for cognition to get going, which may be like life. But you might say the thing that you identified, system integration or some kind of system for coding environmental contingencies, that property itself can have species that is more specific architectural or system-based properties that vary across cases. Maybe there are different kinds of integration, or maybe there are different degrees of integration. I explained my approach to system individuation yesterday by defining a kind of integration. But you know, there are other possible formalisms. Some of you may have heard of Tannoni's phi, or phi as it's sometimes pronounced, which is another way of kind of measuring the extent to which different parts of a system are integrated with each other. And Tannoni has built up what's his integrated information theory of consciousness on the basis of that. So, I don't want to claim that there's only one way to measure integration. And maybe these are different kind of species of a very abstract idea of integration. And similarly for points about having a representational system that tracks environmental contingencies. There are lots of different ways maybe to track environmental contingencies. A weather system might do it by a very different kind of coding system. You might not even think it's a coding system, but a very different kind of system than what appears in a human hippocampus. Back to the property of being integrated. The property of being an integrated system could take various forms across cases, and variations in the single form within a case could do causal explanatory work within that case. Differences in the acuity of contingency coding systems in human hippocampus, these may vary from one individual to another. Maybe one individual human is better at linking together past events in the environment than another individual is. And these can explain differences in the performance. It's also possible that differences in the different kinds of integration might explain differences in patterns in the performance of different species or different cases. But we still seem to be missing the causal explanatory mark, right? The worry is that we were hoping for an overarching notion of cognition, like what it is to be cognitive, and that would then, the presence of that would do causal explanatory work versus the absence of it. Let's say that some kind of contingency tracking code or other is required for cognition. Then the characteristics of that code might be filled in and set in architectural context in different ways to yield species of cognition, different ways of being cognitive. Still, what is shared across cases isn't doing much causal explanatory work. The properties of the code or the specific kind of integration vary, but what's shared are only such properties as possessing some code or other. Thus, the property doing causal explanatory work, accounting for variance in behavior across different or the same kinds of entities, is not the sort of binary property of being cognitive or not. The thing that's going to do most of the causal explanatory work when we look at particular data sets will be variations in a particular scheme At least this seems more likely, partly because behavior across these cases is so different, that the observed behavior, you know, it's not as if we see plants doing the same things that humans do, and then we try to figure out how they, you know, how they do it, or whether they do it the same way or differently. We're just missing that anchor in the first place, except for this very abstract kind of property, like being able to respond flexibly to the environment to some extent or another. And here's some considerations that make matters worse. I'm not trying to convince you that there's nothing left here, that there's nothing that's shared across humans and groups. But I am trying to convince you that it's going to be, if there's anything shared, it's pretty insubstantial and won't play much of a role in cognitive science, to the extent that, as I put in the title of one of my papers, cognitive science isn't about cognition. It's not about something very abstract that we might share with Martians, you know, extraterrestrials, possibly, and plants and groups and so on. So that this concern is particularly worrisome if responsiveness to the environment can be achieved in a variety of ways. Think about the wide variety of ways that responsiveness might be achieved. It might include having a single reused code. It might be achieved by having a host of modules with proprietary codes set in a competition-based architecture, where different modules are kind of competing with each other to gain control. It might include having a genuinely cognitive level neural network model driven by representation of microfeatures, or D, having a serial processing structure that computes over propositions. There's just, you know, then the list can go on. So again, think about the difference between these two things. It's very hard to get your head around sometimes, but it's the difference between having some code or other on the one hand, and difference between having one of these, A rather than B, or B rather than C, right? Having some code or another versus having none at all. That's one distinction. Having A versus B, B versus C, that's another distinction. If the very property of being cognitive is to have some code or other, then the first of those two things has to be doing causal explanatory work. The difference between having some code or other, no details about which one it is, just having some code or other. The difference between that and having none at all has to be doing work, causal explanatory work. But it looks like, as a matter of fact, most of the interesting work will be in cognitive science will be done by the difference between like A and B, or B and C, difference between these specific kinds of architectures or coding schemes. So it's not the difference between being cognitive and not, it's the difference between these different kind of coding schemes that might help to explain variations in data. Moreover, the possibilities for different kinds of architectures, say, are multiplied when we consider the possibility that the use of these particular coding schemes will contribute to cognition only within the context of an architecture, where different architectures may vary with regard to the mechanisms by which, say, the code is altered or its elements are compounded. Even the use of the same code might have different effects if different learning mechanisms, for example, are in place. The upshot seems to be that the property, having some contingency tracking code or other versus not, doesn't itself do much, if any, causal explanatory work in cognitive science. Rather, differences between codes and the architectures in which they're set is of much greater importance, much greater use, is what that should say, in accounting for variance in behavior output. And similar comments will apply to being integrated in some way or other versus not being integrated at all. The bare property, having some code or other, will explain only the most abstract property of the output, that there's some kind of flexibility present. And similar remarks would seem to apply to the bare property of being integrated in some way or another. There might be interesting differences between integration as I've described it, and integration as Tononi describes it, for example, or integration, an example I gave at the end of the lecture yesterday, as Ed Hutchins describes his way of individuating systems by the steepness of the computational gradient. So these might all be interesting sort of measures of integration, but if we treat them as different species of cognition, then we have to ask what cognition, the overarching kind, is. What is it that they're species of? And the only thing that seems to be left is this idea of being integrated in some way or another. But what causal explanatory work does that property, being integrated in some way or another versus not being integrated at all, what work does that do? Just doesn't seem like much. And really, there's a serious upshot here that I mentioned earlier that I'll kind of come back to, which is that we don't want to pull a what's sometimes called in American English a bait and switch, where you hook people in with one idea and then switch to a different one, often one with much different implications, a much grander idea, maybe a forceful idea. So we don't want to kind of start out by identifying this very thin property, does very little work across humans and, say, you know, pigs or humans and plants or humans and groups, and say, okay, we've identified this very thin property, having some code or other, right? And then say, oh, and therefore, all of the rich experience we have or conception we have of cognition and all the behavior it produces, that can now be projected onto pigs and plants and groups and individual neurons, right? That is a big leap. Cognitive science is, to a great extent, an applied science. For example, we would like cognitive science to help us teach reading more effectively, to help us improve memory function in the elderly, to get teenagers to exercise more self-control, to reduce implicit bias in hiring processes, and so on. It's not that such abstractly characterized processes it's not that such abstractly characterized processes as having some capacities to switch fluently between tasks or strategies is irrelevant. As it's not irrelevant that you have some capacity to switch fluently between tasks or strategies. But in pursuing the applied goals of cognitive science, the kinds of things I listed at the top of the slide, what's far more important is the specific profile of task switching mechanisms as they form part of a specific architecture and function within that architecture. For example, when subjects are balancing demands of social and academic life, how does that play out in detail in the lives of teenagers? They're balancing demands of social and academic life. Do they make self-destructive decisions? How do we sort of act on the mechanisms that are operative in young people's lives to help them make better decisions? It's not gonna help to know that they have some system or other of coding, right? You need to know about the specific system, what events are being attended to, what events are being encoded, and how they're being encoded. It's knowledge of those things that may help you influence the outcome of those decision-making processes. We have this further point I just tacked on here because I wanted to be sure to make it at some point in today's lecture, that it may be that ultimately it's the specific suite of activities and forms of behavior that it determines that an integrated system is a cognitive system. It's about this relation to the behavior that we're interested in and connected to the rest of this slide, we're trying to have some effect on. So, summary of this first big portion of the lecture. Scientific or natural kinds are kinds that do causal explanatory work in the scientific enterprise. Our best evidence of sameness of kind is similarities across models. It must be similarities of elements that play a causal explanatory role, evidence of which might be provided by interventionist methods or by accounting for variance in the data. It's not merely incidental similarity or similarity in background conditions or something like that. In the theory of cognition, there's a problematic trade-off between finding similarities that are abstract enough to be shared across cases, say with groups, while also playing a causal explanatory role at that same level of abstraction. Perhaps what this means is that cognitive science doesn't study cognition writ large, some grand overarching idea that a kind that can be shared across humans and other cases like groups and plants. So perhaps what this means is that cognitive science doesn't study cognition writ large, but a particular suite of forms of behavior, including such things as language use, theory construction, chess playing, the running of governments, and so on. All right, I want to turn now to those who argue in support of a realism about group minds or group cognition. Because you can, you know, fairly interpret the first hour of today's lecture as really challenging that notion, as kind of expressing a kind of skepticism about group minds or group cognition or sharing across the cases from individuals and groups. Even where I allowed some possible sharing, I really deflated it by trying to show that it wouldn't be of much importance or interest. So in many actual cases, collections of individuals who themselves are in mental or cognitive states have mental cognitive states of their own. This is a statement of realism. I don't necessarily agree with this. This is what the realists believe. For example, the typical corporation has its own mental or cognitive states as genuine or mental cognitive states of a single entity. Like there's a real thing, Alibaba, whatever, you know, a corporation, a company that as a single subject has its own mental or cognitive states. This is not a matter of metaphor or a figure of speech. Figure of speech might be that the shamed politician was a sacrificial lamb. Well, the politician is not a lamb, literally. It doesn't say bah, right? It's a person, but a person who got in trouble in politics. Maybe someone thinks the person was unfairly put in the role of a scapegoat or a sacrificial lamb. And it's not a summary of individual cases. If you look at the like a government website, maybe it will tell you how large the average family is. So the average American household has 3.13 members, but we're not meant to interpret that literally. There isn't a family that has 3.13 members. People don't come in 13/100ths. The point is that if you're a realist about group minds or group cognition, you're not doing this. You're not merely using figures of speech or mathematical averages. You're saying literally there, the group is like a mind of its own, has its own mental states. And here's an argument from Christian List for realism from a recent paper in a journal called Nous. And this is a direct quote. Premise one, our best social scientific theories of certain social phenomena, for instance, our best theories of the behavior of firms in the marketplace, attribute belief, desire, agency of the functionalist kind to some of the collectives involved, often by representing them as agents in the decision and game theoretic sense. Intermediate conclusion. According to a naturalistic definition of ontological commitment, those theories are then ontologically committed to group agents. Stop. Quick comment about this. You'll see why I would be interested in this approach. List is here. He's very much taking the kind of naturalistic perspective that I have. He's looking at the success of certain kinds of sciences and saying, hey, if these sciences are successful and they succeed by attributing mental states to groups, we have to take that seriously. That's what should drive our ontological commitment. So we should think of these groups as agents, as having beliefs and desires. Back to the direct quotation from Christian List. Premise two, we should at least defeasibly take the ontological commitments of our best scientific theories in any given domain at face value. Conclusion, we should at least defeasibly take our best social scientific theories commitment to group agents at face value. This is quoted from Christian List, 2018. What is it like to be a group agent? Now it's worth noting, to be fair to List here, that he thinks group cognition is supported by social scientific research, by game theoretic or decision theoretic modeling of group behavior. Part of the point of this article that I'm quoting from is to contrast that with the case of group consciousness he's skeptical about group consciousness, so I don't want to attribute that view to him. What's the support for premise one? Why does List claim that our best social science research delivers beliefs and desires for groups? Well, here I'll talk a lot about the work I'm going to turn to List's work with co-author Philip Pettit. I apologize. Today there seem to be more typos in my slides than normal. I'm trying to be more careful about that. So I'll turn to List's work with co-author Philip Pettit. And some of this comes from Philip Pettit's work alone or work with others, but the List and Pettit have written a lot together. Not too long ago, a book on group agency. So Pettit and List emphasize the study of social coordination, social choice theory, in particular, especially in cases in which individual judgments must be aggregated by a process that affects social coordination or grounds the functioning of a social institution, where there is typically disagreement among individuals. For them, voting procedures provide paradigmatic examples. They're thinking about different kinds of situations where voting takes place. Courts are one good example that they use a lot that I'll turn to in a minute. You may have 5 or 7 or 9 justices on a court, and those justices then vote on cases. Pettit and List claim that the most effective way to organize such institutions creates an entity that has independent rationality. The group itself displays a kind of rationality that only makes sense if the group itself is an agent. But agency is a matter of reasoning with beliefs in light of desires to produce output. Consider something called the doctrinal paradox. In cases of judgment aggregation by voting, the outcome can vary depending on whether the vote is structured as a premise-centered procedure or a conclusion-centered procedure. On the premise-centered procedure, members of the group vote only on individual premises. Logic then dictates the truth value assigned to the conclusion. On the conclusion-centered approach, in addition to voting on premises, members of the group vote directly on the conclusion. Here's a picture of a paradox that can result then. Judgment aggregation is concerned with the aggregation of individual judgments on logically interrelated propositions into a set of consistent group judgments. So here is what's called the doctrinal paradox, sometimes the discursive dilemma. This requires a little bit of stage setting to explain. In order to see the problem, we need to talk a little bit about the P's and Q's and what they stand for. P here is that a valid contract was in place. Just be imagining a case where one person is suing someone else in court for damages, for a breach of contract, right? So one question is, was there a valid contract between the two parties? Did one, you know, company enter into a contract with another company to perform services? Now, so was the contract valid? That's one question. Second question is, was it breached? So somebody might believe there was a valid contract, but they might think the behavior in question was not a breach of contract. They didn't break their promises. Somebody else might think that, well, there was no valid contract because consent was not given properly. The procedure of signing the papers, or what have you, wasn't carried out properly. But they do believe that if there were a valid contract, the behavior in question would count as a breach of contract, if there had been. And then the final decision puts these two together, saying that the defendant is liable for damages, has to pay for not living up to their promises, if and only if both of these are true, if and only if there was a valid contract and there was a breach of contract. the promise had to be made and the promise had to be broken in order for the defendant to be liable for damages. Now let's look at the behavior of the individual judges. We've got one judge who says, yes, P, yes, Q, and yes, P and Q. So judge number one believes there was a valid contract, believes there was a breach of contract, and votes that yes, the defendant is liable. In the cases of judge number two and number three, we get a different conclusion. Each is voting on a conclusion-based method, voting that in judge two's case, there was a valid contract, but it wasn't breached. In judge number three's case, there was no valid contract, but it would have been a breach, what was done, if there had been a valid contract. But those two will both vote no on the question of defendant liability. Now, that leaves you with a defendant who gets off, is not liable on the conclusion-based approach. But if we had taken the premise-based approach, majority on, you know, let's look at the columns now. Look at the column for P. Judges one and two both accept P, that there was a valid contract. And so the majority believes there was a valid contract. And in the case of Q, column Q, judges one and three agree that there was a breach of contract. So the majority of the court believes that there was, that the second question was decided in the affirmative. So if we were to follow the premise-based conclusion, we would be forced to vote in favor finding the defendant liable. We would force the defendant to pay damages. So we can see how these two approaches come into conflict with each other, can potentially come into conflict with each other. And one thing that's important then is that for List and Pettit and others who have discussed this, is that frequently we do have to make decisions about individual propositions or individual questions as we move along, because these questions are stretched out over time. So in an individual court case, you imagine these three judges could sit down with the facts of the case and make these sorts of decisions all at once. And there's not much probability of irrationality or conflict. But in the bigger picture, decisions are often stretched out over time, or decisions have to be sensitive to other decisions made quite some time before. In the legal world, this might involve being bound by precedent. If a court treated a similar case or addressed a similar case 2 years ago and made a decision in some legal traditions, then these judges operating now would be bound by that precedent, that earlier decision. And so we want to think of the kind of diachronic generalization of this, how it's stretched out over time. The processes in question may be spread out over time, and decisions about various related matters may not be conceptualized as part of the same process. Nevertheless, if the premises are logically related, endorsements of them can dictate a different view on a new matter than might be reached if the vote were taken only on that issue or only on the conclusion. So one way to think about this is in terms of kind of conflict in these cases between modus ponens and modus tollens, which are Latin terms for two common reasoning patterns. Right? Put them both up here. Modus ponens, they're both valid deductive logic reasoning patterns. Modus ponens says, take premise, if P then Q, premise P, those two together will yield Q. Say, if P is true, then Q has to be true. Ah, P is true. Well, therefore it follows that Q. With modus tollens, you start with the same conditional premise. If P is true, then Q is. You find out that Q is false. Well, you can move to the conclusion that P is false. If something is a cow, then it's a mammal. True. You find out that this thing in front of you is not a mammal. Well, then it must not be a cow, because cows are mammals. If a conclusion-based approach is taken, the question arises whether we should somehow enforce consistency, which might be productively thought of as a form of modus tollens in the diachronic case. Imagine voting in favor of the premises of the modus ponens and then voting not Q. In that case, consistency can be achieved by reasoning backwards by modus tollens to a rejection of P, which contradicts the vote on premise two of MP. So it seems like we have a risk of inconsistency that we might somehow try to get rid of. If we see that the previous commitments entail something that we don't accept now, we're in a bind. Because we might want to go back and revise earlier decisions, but we can't always do that. Philip and Pettit and List are worried that we're sort of committed to the previous decisions. Rationality would require consistency with them. So if you voted in the past in favor of the premises of the modus ponens, if P then Q and P, and then you voted not Q, you'd be in trouble, because that would lead to a rejection of P, but that's already been voted on in the positive and the affirmative when you voted on the premises of the modus ponens, as I put it. So this is just another way of trying to make the conflict clear. Maybe it was clear enough from the earlier slide about the doctrinal paradox. The fear that Pettit and List have is that it seems that one can have individual responsiveness or correct collective rationality, but you can't have both. You cannot have both for sure. Individual sort of freedom here can lead to a violation of collective rationality. And one possible way to have both is the case in which all individuals commit themselves to the premise-based procedure, in which case the process is responsible to all of the individual's commitments. They commit to a rational constraint on their vote on the conclusion if one is taken. So this is, in a way, my suggestion on how to think about this. It doesn't require the group to somehow have a mind of its own to override the individual. It's that individuals commit themselves to the premise-based procedure in certain contexts. Pettit argues that the discursive dilemma will arise for any purposive group and that it is solved by adopting a premise-based procedure. That seems sensible enough. If the group doesn't do so, this allows contradictory behavior. If the group allows this contradictory behavior, it will become a laughing stock, he says. And I guess what I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm feeling a little pressured here. But what I want to do in these last couple of minutes is talk about how messy real life is. That is, Pettit and List seem to be approaching these cases as if behavior, as if social institutions are rational. They're sort of taking for granted that social institutions are rational. And what worries me is that to the extent, really two things. One is to the extent that social choice theory, the use of these kind of simple logical rules, to the extent that that helps to account for social phenomena, is pretty minimal. Like most of what we want to explain is much more complex. So that's an observation that's worth keeping in mind, that social choice theory isn't really as powerful a part of social science as they claim, or to the extent that it is, it's like a model fragment. But also to the extent that it is, it's also explicable by individual rationality. Adding a group level of rationality doesn't seem to help. The individual commits to a premise-based procedure, and that's what makes it work. The premise-based procedure doesn't just sort of mysteriously arise at the group level. It's got to be because individuals commit to it. And furthermore, here's some bits I'm going to skip here. I'm having trouble advancing my slides for some reason. It was about the messiness of American politics and how actually political parties are inconsistent. And, here, I'll start here. Human institutions are messy. When we're dealing with courts, corporations, or political entities, human affairs are often complicated. Behavior is inconsistent. Individuals change their minds or decide to ignore past promises or commitments. This is, perhaps sadly, the way of the world. When an institution is rational, when we do see rationality, it is because individuals have made certain commitments, for example, to follow a premise-based procedure by being committed to following precedent on a court. Let's return to list premise number one. Our best social scientific theories of certain social phenomena, for instance, our best theories of the behavior of firms in the marketplace, attribute belief, desire, agency of the functionalist kind to some of the collectivities involved, often by representing them as agents in the decision and game theoretic sense. This is the direct quotation from Christian List's realist argument given earlier. Now, I've questioned the social science dimension of this claim that, in fact, we get much mileage out of these attributions. What really explains the patterns we see is the variation in individual decisions. Sometimes individuals decide to follow the premise-based approach, and you see a certain kind of rationality existing at the group level. In a court, members of the court can agree to follow precedent and be bound by previous decisions. And so perhaps they grit their teeth and they vote for conclusions they don't agree with, but that preserves rationality at the group level, what appears to be rationality at the group level. But in lots of other cases, the group rationality is not explained. But my point is that in either kind of case where group rationality is maintained or group rationality is not maintained, the explanation will be in terms of the individual's commitment to rationality, certain procedure, or the individual's desire to, make other decisions, the kind of decisions that lead to messiness in politics and law. So part of the question here is really about double counting. List and Pettit don't think this is a kind of double counting. They don't think that they're somehow adding unnecessary rationality at the group level. So they consider reasons, criticisms of their view, One of the most compelling is the double counting objection, according to which there are too many subjects or intentional agents on the realist view. The group is an unnecessary addition of an additional agent, violating a canon of simplicity. Pettit's response is that the group agent has beliefs and desires that can differ from the group members' beliefs, desires. So the group agent is not extraneous. Now, but I just gave you an account of how that can happen. Like we can have, in the case of the discursive dilemma earlier on the court, we can have three members of the court who vote to hold the defendant liable, even though only one of the three actually believes the defendant is liable. So the majority of the group members don't believe the defendant's liable, but they're committed to, as individuals, they're committed to following the premise-based procedure. So we have a perfectly good individual level explanation. We don't have to sort of be mystery mongers here and say, oh my gosh, there's group level group level rationality that can't be explained any other way. We need to posit a group agent. That does not seem to be an apt response to the case. Cognitive states and processes, the reality of which we have independent reason to accept, suffice perfectly well to explain the outcomes in question. Courts issue opinions that don't match the opinions of the majority of the constituent individuals when they do, because each of the individuals on the court is committed to precedent and so on. So they said earlier that, press releases from a company don't show that the company is somehow speaking. It just shows that there are processes in place at a company to allow individuals' linguistic capacities to be combined to issue in a public statement. Pettit and List think it is not fair to put the question in this way, and I'll end with this point. They think that doing so creates an unnecessary competition between the individual and the group, entities at different levels. And they talk here about supervenience and realization and causal competition and causal exclusion. They think a lot of metaphysics can come in, but I think they've got the whole thing wrong because they're interested in this relationship between levels. And this isn't the point about the relationship between levels. The question is whether once we have admitted cognitive and mental states properties into our ontology, how many instances of them we need to do the causal explanatory work that needs to be done. Their point about relations between levels misses this. The idea is that this is an intra-domain point about simplicity. We're in sort of one domain. We're thinking about how much cognition we need to stick into our model, a model that could have things from what are thought of as other levels, because I'm not particularly a fan of levels. I think we have a phenomenon, we have some behavioral data, we have a press release, we have a court decision. We want to explain that. We can use lots of different resources to explain for that, combine them in a single model. But when we think about one particular kind of resource, we think about how much of it we need. And there's a thing called quantitative simplicity, a principle of quantitative simplicity. And we'll tell you to use only as much of that stuff as you need. And what Pettit and List seem to me to be doing, and other fans of GroupMind seem to be doing, is violating this principle of qualitative simplicity. They want to include more cognition than you need, more mentality than you need. Once you have the commitments of the individual justices, you can see why there is a decision that deep down only a minority of them support. You don't need to add additional cognition at the group level. Okay, I'll stop there.